Welcome to the post-correction phase of the Planetary Tantra Talks. And with the main Turton, John Lash, in mega high gear as we navigate with the Wisdom Goddess, please let this passage from the Nag Hammadi Codices sink deeply into your consciousness. When Pistis saw the impiety of the Lord Archon, she was filled with anger. Acting in her invisible form, she spoke in this way: "You are mistaken, blind one, false deity who cannot see. There is an immortal, luminous child, the Anthropos, who came into existence before you, and who will appear among your modeled forms. This luminous child will trample you in scorn, just as a potter's clay is pounded into a lump. And you will sink away to your proper zone, the abyss of gravity, along with those who belong to your legion. For at the consummation of your work, the entire defect of archontic illusion, exposed in the light of truth, will be abolished, and that illusion will be as if never had been. On the Origin of the World." Okay, and welcome to Planetary Talk number 11. The date is August the 1st, 2011. We are one, maybe 2 days before the first viewing of the Sunset Crescent, bringing us into the cycle of Bhairavi. And in addition to that, we are right on the cusp of a massive perigee surge, which we will talk about here in a minute and what it might entail. So, John, I welcome you to our first, not our first, but our second double-digit interview here. And I understand you have something you would like to read here at the outset.
Yes. Thanks, Thomas. It's good to be back with you. I just came across this a few days ago, and somehow it seemed timely. Poem by Robert Graves. You know, Robert Graves used to live not far from here, where I live in Andalusia, Spain. He used to live on the island of Mallorca.
Interesting.
A place called Deia. It's a very beautiful place. A very beautiful stone village. And he's still known. He's still remembered there. And I think his children live there. Anyway, Robert Graves wrote The White Goddess, which is an amazing book that forms a cornerstone of the goddess revival. And when my book was reviewed in the LA Times in December of 2006, just after it came out, it was compared to The White Goddess by Robert Graves because of the power of the message regarding the goddess. Is shared by both books. Anyway, Robert Graves was a very well-known poet in his time, and I just thought maybe we could kick off by if I read one of his poems.
Please, go ahead. I'm dying to hear it.
It's a short poem of three stanzas, and it goes like this. All saints revile her, and all sober men, ruled by the god Apollo's golden mean, in scorn of which we sail to find her in distant regions likeliest to hold her, whom we desired above all things to know, sister of the mirage and echo. It was a virtue not to stay, to go our headstrong and heroic way, seeking her out at the volcano's head among pack ice, or where the track had faded beyond the cavern of the seven sleepers, whose broad, high brow was white as any leper's, whose eyes were blue, with rowan berry lips, with hair curled, honey-colored, to white hips. The sap of spring in the young wood astir will celebrate with green the mother, and every songbird shout a while for her. But we are gifted, even in November, rawest of seasons, with so huge a sense of her nakedly worn magnificence, we forget cruelty and past betrayal, heedless of where the next bright bolt may fall.
Very nice. I like the ending of that. The bright bolt, where the bright bolt will fall.
Yeah, it fits, doesn't it?
Yes, it does.
VV is hitting us with bolts, bright bolts. That's what these perigee surges are. And I think it's absolutely wonderful that although he doesn't mention the name, Robert Graves, who was a tremendous mythologist, wrote books on mythology. For instance, the Greek myths, two-volume Greek myths, is a standard reference book, was obviously referring to the myth of the Argonauts, who struck out on the great voyage and the journey in search of the Golden Fleece, which is a metaphor for the organic light. It's really beautiful that that poem comes back now, floating on the flotsam and jetsam of time and tides, and we have it as a kind of invocation to this nautical journey we're undertaking here.
Yes, you've referred to the crew as the Argonauts in some of your communications.
That's right. We could call ourselves Argonauts, and that would be a fitting poetic title for those who undertake this Gaian navigation experiment, as I'm calling it.
And the search for the Golden Fleece is a metaphor for the organic light, come across the organic light and then to live in it, I would imagine.
Well, gold or amber, there's a deep occult secret in that myth. It would take quite a while to unravel it. Basically, there's a wonderful event, wonderful aspect of interactivity with the wisdom goddess encoded in that myth. See, one of the things that the organic light will do, because it's alive, it's a medium of life, super life, super alive, and as I say, animated and animating. And one of the things that it will do, among the various things it will do, such as taste you, I don't know if you've read about that, Thomas, but
yes,
little thing called Severed Rose on meta history.
Yes.
The memoir of how I discovered the significance of the organic light and was able to reveal that secret of the mysteries, you know, which was not, it was preserved and guarded and protected, I should say, by a vow of silence, but not by a vow of secrecy as such.
Mm-hmm.
There was no secrecy in the mysteries as such. They were not secret societies such as we've had on this planet, unfortunately, since around the beginning of the 17th century, with the Rosicrucians and the various Masonic orders.
Right.
The ancient mysteries, especially the Levantine mysteries, were not secret societies in that sense. But they did keep secret some of their activities in order to protect the integrity of the mystical process. And so there was a vow of silence surrounding the organic light. And although there are two or three sources in antiquity which refer to the light, and you find them cited in Not in His Image, no one has done what I've done in that book, which is to describe in explicit language the properties of the light and its interactive nature. And it will taste you, as I said, when it tastes you, it produces a certain effect in your body, which is unmistakable and consistent with each person. And also, this is one of the really fantastic properties of the organic light, is that it will take on different hues depending on what it encounters. And it shows its pleasure because it is the living body of the goddess.
Mm-hmm.
It is her living raiment of pleromic luminosity. And as a live medium, it will show its pleasure by taking on different hues. And the hue that it assumes when it is in the presence of pure humanity, when it encounters the Anthropos, when it meets a human being standing in its currents who carries the true radiance of the Anthropos, and that innocent and invincible power that is in us, it turns gold. It has a golden or amber hue that it takes on. And that is the significance of the golden fleece.
Is this an internal vision that you see, or is this something that you're actually seeing externally?
No, you see it right in front of you. It's not internal.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow. Huh. Wow. Would you like to go on a bit with that, or would you like to put that off for another time?
I just want to say that I always love to have the opportunity to talk about the organic light.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm beginning to feel when I wrote Not in His Image 5 or 6 years ago, when it came out in November 2006, no one had ever used that term. And no one has really quite picked up on it even yet, although people are tempted to do so, some other people. And they're being cautious about it, which they damn well better be. But I'm really not worried, because it's an inviolable subject. And I am absolutely confident that in the time since I wrote Not in His Image and made these totally unprecedented disclosures of the organic light, that supernatural phenomenon is occurring more and more frequently and spontaneously to people. So I am extremely grateful that I was able to provide that syntax and was able to put down on paper for public knowledge something that was never, ever disclosed publicly. But this is the time for that to be disclosed, because the beauty of the organic light and the beauty and power of the wisdom goddess in her naked presence, in her naked magnificence, as Gray says in this poem, is breaking in upon the human mind. What is going to determine this planetary shift that we're in today is a tidal wave of beauty as the goddess makes her presence known. And people are writing me and saying they're having dreams of women in white robes. They are dreaming of white animals.
Mm-hmm.
And all of these epiphanies of white that occur can be taken as clues and indications that the white goddess is approaching us. And so I think it's relevant to cite that poem now and to bring up the subject of the organic light. and any encounters with it, any testimony that anyone can provide is welcome. And some people are writing in. Some of the crew members are writing in about this. Because one of the things that is going to happen in correction is an escalation of the frequency of spontaneous encounters with the organic light. Now, I don't say is going to happen. Excuse my syntax. Is happening in correction.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So it's the actions are initiated on Sophia's side. She, in a sense, senses who she's going to present herself to. You can't, in that sense, call her to you. Or am I reading this
in
the wrong
way? No, you can. It's both, Thomas. It's both.
Okay.
You can hold in your heart and in your mind ardent desire to witness the organic light. You can hold that. And that would have because everything concerning the goddess is interactive, that would play a role in inducing the experience, perhaps. But also, not, but also, to a large degree, she's simply going to overwhelm us with the presence of that light and with that luminosity. It's literally breaking in from the supernatural dimension into the human mind.
Yes, and I know it's such a big topic that we'd probably need to devote a whole hour to or more just to that. So I'm very glad that you brought that out now, but let's start to get into more so we can finish up with the kind of the orientation here that we have set up, if that's okay with you.
Sure.
Okay.
Sure, we'll just work from your notes. That would be fine with me today.
Okay, fantastic. First, I'd like to get a few comments from you on, you know, we're right here on this August 2nd surge, and you have written in the notes to the crew that this is going to come in through kind of a kundalini type of a way. It's going to come in through the lower back, and it could come in as kind of a massive dose of sacred anger, as you say here. Is there anything you could comment on this about the surge that's coming on in the Bhairavi cycle?
Well, sure. You know, last time, I believe it was last time, the 9th or 10th interviews we've done together, you opened the interview by reading a magnificent passage from On the Origin of the World. And in a way, you could say it's sort of a prophetic passage. There really are not prophecies in the Nag-Kamadhi material. I want to point that out. Prophecies are bad news, and we don't do prophecies in Telestic shamanism. Prophecies belong to the religious psychosis of the Abrahamic religions. We steer as far as possible away from prophecies and prophetic pronouncements, such as you find in the Old Testament prophets, Daniel, and that kind, usually prophesying doom and prophesying the retribution of the Father God upon humanity. All this is a very sick trip, which has been used to frighten and control people for hundreds or for centuries.
Mm-hmm.
But there is a sort of prophetic passage there. It's in a pre-terrestrial setting. The Divine Sophia sees, to her astonishment, that this aberrant species has appeared. The Archons are like locusts. You know, they're mm-hmm. a cyborg, inorganic cyborg species. And she realizes in her aeonic wisdom, in her aeonic perception, which is vast, that when humanity does eventually emerge in the experiment that she had been contemplating, the Archons are going to be looming around the scene, lurking in the corridors, and mm-hmm. trying to mess up the experiment, quite frankly. And she perceives this now. She perceives that she herself, by her plunge from the Pleroma, this massive plume of plasmic luminosity that she is, has created, inadvertently, has created this this problem. And so she addresses the Archons, and she addresses the Lord Archon, and makes this prophetic statement, which you read so beautifully. Namely, it's as if she says, I promise you, the blind one, she calls the head of the Archons blind. This is an important detail, you know. One of the things people have noted regarding the great ETs, they've many enormous amounts, volumes and volumes of testimony have been recorded about people encountering the great ETs, the embryonic form of the Archons. And they have these big eyes, right? These bug eyes that wrap around their face, right? Everyone's
right.
Icon of Whitley Strieber's Communion, very unfortunate book in brainwashing. But, you know, Whitley Strieber is nothing but a tabloid psychotic who wrote grade B scripts for Hollywood. I mean, what the hell do you expect from someone like that? Pretending to be a psychic, pretending to be an illuminated person with a message for mankind, really contributing to the hoax of the Archons, is Whitley Strieber. Anyway, on the cover of his book, you have this iconic figure, and when we look at that, we may think various things. But I would ask you to bear in mind what Sophia said, what Sophia calls those beings, blind. You're actually looking at beings who are blind. They can't really see. What do they see? Mm-hmm. You know, when they stand in front of a human being, which they can do briefly by flitting into our dimension, just briefly in a borderline or liminal fashion, or which they can do by invoking their virtual reality techniques. More often, that's what they do. They pull the human being into their virtual reality scenario, and then they stand there and confront the human being. This has happened many, many times. Many people have recorded it. What happens is that then they stare at the person, and this is considered to be terribly troubling and frightful.
Mm-hmm.
But actually, if you realize that they are completely blind, they can't see you. What they see is not you as you and I would see another human being in the sensuous reality of the five senses. What they see is a kind of schematic of a person. You know, this has actually been represented in Hollywood very accurately. Hollywood does a lot of these things. Hollywood shows a lot of paranormal reality in its movies, as you know. You can read that whatever way you like. I won't go into the question of why they do so. Mm-hmm. But maybe if you remember seeing the film The Terminator with Albert Schwarzenegger or Arnold Schwarzenegger, when the Terminator entity who comes from another time dimension lands on Earth there, and first he goes into like this roadhouse bar, you know?
Right.
And you see from the Terminator's viewpoint what people look like. You know, you see this, the film shows you, and it shows like in the corner of the film, it shows this kind of readout, you know, of this schematic readout of the heat of the person, of the shape of the person. And if you would imagine that that is actually how Archons perceive, they perceive, for instance, they wouldn't see a house. They would see something like the architectural plan for a house.
Mm-hmm.
They can't see a house. They are blind to the living. This is remarkable. And you need to know this to stand up the Archons. And that's what we're doing now in this correction phase of Sophia's, this first phase of Sophia's correction. Really standing up for the first time, humanity, standing up to the Archons in the way that she more or less prophesied in this passage. She said, I promise you, blind one, when you reach the consummation of your works, which is absurdity and senselessness, in your futile attempt to control and deceive, You would be crushed by that luminous child, meaning us.
Yes.
See?
Yes.
So this is a beautiful statement, and it puts us right where we are today. It puts us right in the correction with her. As I've been showing in the crew notes, Sophia makes a number of hits on us. I don't know what else to call them. She just is like striking our psychosomatic and neuronal circuits with her mm-hmm. intention in such a way as to wake us up, break us out of the archonic spell, and give us power to face these archons. And one of these hits is happening tomorrow on August the 2nd. And this is a very exceptional hit because it occurs in a region of it's reflected by an event in the region of the zodiac that is back earlier in the zodiac than all the previous hits that she has delivered since March 19th.
What do you mean by it's back? What the position or?
Yeah, the position. You see, I track okay. these hits by the shift of the lunar perigee through the constellations. So each time that there is what I call a hit or bolt or jolt from her intention to correct us, to snap us out of the aromatic spell, or to trigger in us some aspect of our divine potential. This is how intimately and powerfully, Thomas, she's acting on us right now. And I can track those events by the movement of the lunar perigee through the background of the constellations. And that movement is rather complex, and I'm taking some time to describe it in the crew notes and also in what I'm writing on metahistory.org if you want to follow it.
Right.
But generally speaking, the movement of the lunar perigee, the point of the moon's orbit where it's closest to the Earth, will advance by fits and starts through a constellation. By advancing, I mean it moves through the constellation, through the zodiac, in the natural order of the constellations, which would be Aries, Taurus, Gemini, Ram, Bull, Twins. So it started on March 19th in the Virgin, right between the eyes of the Virgin. That was where the first hit happened.
Yeah, that's very interesting, very significant.
Yeah, right between the eyes of the constellation of the Virgin. And then it advanced down the body of the Virgin, which, as you know, is very long, because the constellation of the Virgin is the biggest in the sky, and it's at least 45 degrees long, making
right.
it one-eighth of the zodiac, or it could be even calculated to be longer, like 48 degrees. But an odd thing happened just between the last hit, which was in July 7th, and now, is that rather than continuing to advance through the constellation of the Virgin, it reversed and it went back. It went back to the constellation before the Virgin, which is the Lion. And so a remarkable thing is that at times, and I'm going to trace this very carefully in the next 3 years, at times the lunar perigee jumps back and it repeats the hit. So she's going to repeat the hits that she already made during the coming months. And I'm going to characterize
okay.
what each one of those is.
Right.
It's a double whammy situation, if you want to put it that way.
Interesting. So she'll be repeating the 319 hit,
That's
I
right.
would guess.
She won't
that'd
be repeating
be the, next
the
one
March
coming
19th
up, then.
Hit, because that was a unique hit right between the
Oh,
hours.
I'm sorry, March, yes, March 19th. I
but she'll be repeating the April 17th hit and the May 15th hit. She'll be repeating three hits that she's made already. And I'm going to specify exactly what she is doing by these jolts to our system and to our species, neuronal and biogenetic structure, mutating us. Not mutating us into some other kind of freak species. No. Mutating us out of the grotesque freaks that we've become. Come on, you know?
Yeah.
Into true human beings.
Yeah. Yeah. We first need to become true human beings before anything else.
That's right. That's right. And she's bringing us around. So what I want to point out now, and then we can, because we're getting close to the halfway mark here, and then we can go on with your points of your agenda. I'd like to do that. Is what is, as you suggested, so unique about the hit that's happening on August 2nd, which would be calibrated to 23 degrees of the sign Virgo, that is 173 degrees of the ecliptic scale. And when you look in the constellations, that places it exactly conjunct the star, the nebula, which marks the tail of the constellation of the Lion. The Lion has two very prominent stars in it. One is the star in its heart, called Regulus, the heart of the Lion. And the other is the star at the end of its tail, which is called the nebula. And so you could say that if we as individuals are responding to the strike that Vivi's making tomorrow, we're going to have a tiger by the tail. But the tiger is going to be us. And basically, I read this hit as an activation like nothing we have ever seen of the Kundalini force in the human body. And it would not be surprising if people during correction and starting right now, starting tomorrow, and continuously from this point on, would not be surprising if people report having spontaneous surges of Kundalini. And Kundalini can, erupt spontaneously, you know.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Some people don't know that, Thomas. Some people think that you can only have a Kundalini uprising through the chakras of the spine and so forth if you practice these elaborate techniques of Kundalini yoga and so forth. Well, that's not at all the case. In fact, when I was 16 years old, I had a spontaneous Kundalini uprising that went on for 6 months. So this can happen and is currently happening to people. And in conjunction with this activation of Kundalini is an even equally significant event of release connected with Bhairavi. As you noted, current surge tomorrow happens at the very beginning of the shift of the Dakini called Bhairavi, which means the terrible.
Exactly. That if it happens tomorrow, some of us could be lucky enough to see the sunset crescent right on the 2nd of August.
That's right, right on the 2nd of August. Yeah, extraordinary moment. And from that day onward, things will not be the same in the way we live with ourselves and the way we live with the situation we're facing. Because what Bhairavi handles, see, the Shakti, the Dakinis of the Shakti cluster handle energies. They are energies that handle energies. They are supernatural frequencies that work in the human psyche and in our emotional makeup and in our mental and imaginative faculties. And they are just as real as anything you can name, my friend. They are just as real as oxygen.
Yeah.
In fact, they're more like nitrogen, to be honest, but, you know, this is what they're like. They're real.
Uh-huh.
And they discharge through the psyche massive eruptions of energy for our purposes. And what Bhairavi manages and what she releases, along with Vivi, is sacred anger.
Sacred anger.
Sacred anger is an absolutely essential ingredient to correction, to our participation in correction. Why is that? It's very, very simple. Allow me to define what sacred anger is. It's anger you feel in the protection of life. That's sacred anger. So if a mother is out in a park with her children and her little boy is playing over at the swings, and she notices some pervert pedophile happened to come up and accost her son, or try to sneak him away, or try to molest that child.
Mm-hmm.
She goes there, and she goes after that person with sacred anger. The sacred anger is anger for the preservation and protection of life. And if we don't have this anger up and running, we don't have a chance of making a better world here as the archonic system of false authority comes down. Don't just sit back passively and watch it come down. We also bring it down and keep it down with the force of sacred anger.
Mm-hmm.
And I would point out something just before I turn it over to you, Thomas. Perpetrators and the globalist psychopaths, who in their grandiosity of their egotism and their false imagination, believing they are gods, believing they can mind control the whole human race, whatever the fuck it is those idiots believe, and their Mickey Mouse forms of magic for achieving this, they understand anger. It's a language they understand. And it's necessary in the approach to Gaian ethics that I intend to present now in the next 2 months. I intend to talk a lot about Gaian ethics. It's impossible to have Gaian ethics without anger. You see, what Gaian ethics is a humane, life-protecting ethics with teeth.
Mm.
We need ethics with teeth, you know, like a lion's teeth. Like a tiger's teeth. Why do shamans who take the animal powers upon themselves, the Native American shamans, the shamans of the Arctic region, or the shamans of Africa, wear teeth? We need to wear teeth. And if we're going to have any ethics on this planet, it's going to protect humanity and the future generations from these psychopathic control freaks who are hoaxing and deceiving everyone and committing atrocious acts of social evil in secrecy. We need ethics with teeth. You see, the Christian ethic, as I've shown in Not in His Image, the Christian ethic of love your enemies and do good to them who hurt you was written by the perpetrators.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
Yeah, and it's, you don't have to be a genius to see that. And it was and is an ethic without teeth. It's toothless, you know, because it doesn't contain in it the power that is necessary for a moral and humane human being to defend its own humanity. And so the wonderful moment when we can defend humanity, each one of us, and as teams, as groups, as communities, and eventually as a whole global planetary force of Gaian warriors, that moment is now. And the ingredient that we need to have is sacred anger, and she herself is activating the circuits of sacred anger in our species with this perigee surge.
So it's very significant that they're both coming up right at the same time, isn't it? Vairavi combining with this surge that's going to come in through a kundalini type of a formation.
Yeah, it's absolutely beautiful timing, and it's a stunning coincidence. And it's, of course, it's not a coincidence, because all of the Mahavidyas and Dakinis of the Shakti cluster are aspects of Gaia. So they will all chime in, as it were, each month in one way or another. They will chime in to the process of correction. But this is an absolutely stunning and magnificent example of how that's going to be done. And it needs to be.
Mm-hmm.
It needs to be. Because we really have been taken a long, long way from sacred anger. You know, the pagans knew what sacred anger was. And they formulated it in a social ethic, which they called Lex Talionis. The law.
Lex Talionis.
Yeah, Lex Talionis. You know, Talionis, which means of the claw, you know? Retaliation. Retaliation, that's the law. And that was made, that is the pagan, a fundamental of pagan ethics. And our species is on the threshold of recovering that element of retaliatory violence against perpetrators. It's absolutely necessary for our survival. And it's coming in like gangbusters, if I might use, that funny expression.
Yeah, you know, those were the exact energies that I was trying to express when we first started talking in January and February, after all these things that had happened to me after the Guyan Tantra Val. Just literally almost tearing me from limb to limb, you know, trying to deal with these energies. And they were mostly what I would now characterize with those words of sacred anger. I mean, I was tormented by him, possessed by him for a couple months on end, actually.
That's right, you know.
That could be what we're seeing coming up in the next few hours, actually. Huh?
Oh, totally. And it doesn't surprise me, Thomas, because I haven't met you, and in certain respects, you're a perfect stranger to me, you know. But on the other hand, from one warrior to another, we have our affinities, don't we?
Yes,
and,
absolutely.
I am not at all surprised. You know how it is when the Shakti cluster hits you, and other people know. It hits you so hard that it touches that in you, which is the most profound desire and disposition of your life.
Mm-hmm.
Of your life.
Yeah.
You know, if you don't even know what is the most profound desire of your life, or in Dakini syntax, what is your highest desire, and most people don't, if you don't even know it, that's where the Shakti cluster engages you when you come on board. And and for you, obviously, it's clear that that highest desire is to protect and preserve life and to be in the rank of the warriors for the goddess, for the wisdom goddess. So I'm not surprised that it hit you in that way. And I know you were in a tremendous turbulence. You had to go up to your place almost every day and do your warrior exercises just to handle what was being released in you, right?
Yeah, just to hang on, and I'm still doing it. Yeah, did it today as well. Well, this is good. This is an exciting time then. This is, and probably people will be listening to this, some people, right during the actual peak of things.
Yes,
get
they will.
Uploaded in time, so that'll be interesting as well.
Right.
Well,
but
John,
worry
that leads
if you
me right
peak,
in...
folks, because the peak happens and it will affect you either way. And the point is to have the syntax, which I'm providing for you now, to have the descriptive framework to integrate this. And that will come over the period of this month in its entirety. Okay?
Yeah. Fantastic. Now, that leads right into what I want to go into next. I was really just flabbergasted by the talk about the chiral lock being released on March 19th. That to me is such an incredibly interesting concept, and I want to kind of run a couple things by you regarding that.
Sure.
So the chiral lock, you describe it as a freeze of the overlap of the right and left peripheral fields of the left and right, which you can equate to the first attention and the second attention. And I just want to run these three things, two things that happened to me. I've been doing sun gazing off and on whenever I find myself out in nature. And shortly after the earthquake and then after the 319 events, I was looking up at the sun in around 4 o'clock, because it's getting close to setting at that time. And I mean, this is going to sound crazy, but the sun just started dancing back and forth and slightly up and down for, I would guess, at least, you know, 30, 40 seconds. And it was the strangest thing. I was just locked into it. There was nothing I could do. But it was definitely a play between the right and left of my vision. And, you know, it was kind of caught me off guard and kind of put me into a heightened state of awareness in a sense. And when I left to go back to my car to come home, there were two wild dogs that are always up there on the mountains hanging out. And they were just sitting shoulder to shoulder, looking right out, well, right over where I was, over at the sun. And they were in this dazed look that you wouldn't expect to see from a wild dog. So that's one strange thing that happened. And the other one was when I was driving to Aikido, to the dojo, just during the Chinamasta beginning, and I was caught my glimpse of the Sunset Crescent as I'm driving. And I was stopped at a stop sign or stoplight. And the Sunset Crescent did the exact same thing. It just started flitting back and forth. And I had no control over how my eyes were interpreting this. And it was just a very strange thing. And when I did go to the dojo then and started training with everyone, early in the practice, I got a pretty good throw by someone and hit my head, not in a dangerous way, but just enough to cause what you'd usually see as stars. And when I stood up, all around me looked like little, this is going to sound crazy again, but bowling pins, you know, very small, kind of greenish black, just spinning around all around me. There must have been dozens of them. And this went on for, you know, 30 or 40 seconds. And I didn't want to tune into them because I didn't want to have to deal with this situation with all these my friends there. But those things that I saw flying around me were as real as anything I've ever seen in my normal awareness. So anyway, I'm just putting those out. And if there's anything that could relate into the chiral lock being released, I would like to hear about that.
Well, that's very interesting, Thomas. There could be any number of anomalous effects of this happening. Let me give you an example of one thing that I suspect has been happening, and it's the kind of thing that you would have to have an occult understanding to even conceive of. And it's not the kind of thing that would necessarily be reported socially. It might not be reported by the media. It would be a phenomenon that could sweep through the world and show up in various places, and yet people would not necessarily realize exactly what is happening. And that is, quite simply, that people will lose their concentration. You won't be able to concentrate on their jobs. You won't be able to concentrate on the ordinary things they concentrate on. And this has even been happening to me. And to my companion here, Kundry's been saying the same thing. And a number of people from the crew have written in. It kind of goes like this. The power just went out here, by the way. As I was just saying that as a result of Vivi hitting and opening the chiral lock, that people would be losing their capacity to concentrate. And I'd mentioned that my friend here, my companion, Kundry, has been remarking this for some time, and I myself as well. For instance, I can concentrate on small things that I enjoy, like a small task that will last 10 or 15 minutes. For instance, a drawing something, drawing a constellation, or a small practical task around the house. But it's very difficult for me to read or to concentrate for a long period of time, like an hour or 2 hours on a book or something like that. Because what has happened actually is that my first attention has been freed, and I actually have more power in my first attention than I had before March 19th, but I don't know quite how to handle it yet. And many people are experiencing this, have been written in about this, that they just can't settle on anything, they just can't concentrate. So that would be the effect of this strike on the first attention. Equally so, I'm getting testimony from the effects on the right eye, the right side, which is the dreaming attention, is that some people are saying they feel themselves in just kind of swept up into a vague kind of reverie, swept up into just a kind of mood of just wanting to dream, just wanting to float. And this is because the power of the second attention has now been released from this lock. And what we need to do now is to handle those powers and use them and apply them and work with them together. See, the power of the archons, by creating this lock and this and putting the two plates, stabilizing them and freezing them along a seam, allows them to paralyze those two abilities so that they don't work together. But in order to realize our full human potential, we need to work together and relate our reasoning power and our imaginative or dreaming power. And so we have been under that spell of the chiral lock for quite a long time, especially since the invention of television and these other digital and informational technologies, which seize our attention. And anything that, as I explained in the Kronos, Thomas, anything that reduces human attention to a microsecond enforces this chiral lock. And so that has been broken, that has been changed, and we're really operating in an entirely different mindset right now. But we perhaps that would proceed without us even knowing it if we didn't have the descriptive syntax to tell us it was happening.
Indeed, yes. And so we're talking about post 319. So I'm just in my own mind, I was trying to recollect things that happened shortly thereafter, and that's what I came up with. But you say you're getting testimonies and reports from people of similar.
Yeah, it's been going on. It's been noted for about 3 months now.
Hmm.
3 or 4 months. And it's just the first effect, the first consequence. Each one of these strikes that I'm describing is an event that can be verified by an observation of yourself and an observation of nature around you and in the social order around you. And that's what's so exciting about this Gaian navigation experiment, is that the crew members are taking the opportunity to do that and reporting to me and sharing among themselves on the Terra Navis forum these mm-hmm. observations that they're making about what Sophia is doing moment by moment in real time.
Now, you've noted here in the notes that with the first bolt, with the 319 that shattered and dissolved the lock, you mention here that you have a way that you have an exercise for keeping it supple and sliding. And if you would like to go into that, I would very much like to hear how we can facilitate this to make it more smooth.
Well, how about this? It would take a little while to do that, probably about 10 minutes to take you through it.
Mm-hmm.
We're at 50
mm-hmm.
minutes right now. How about we take mm-hmm. that up immediately in interview 12, and at the
sure.
same time, as I talk about the exercise to keep the chiral lock fluid and open, I'll talk about the other way that the archons get us at the back of the head and how to deal with that.
Oh, this is amazing. I mean, that's what I was just going to ask you. That's the next right there on the list. I could literally read what I have written there. I mean, that's very funny.
Well, I'll give you a little preview of that, which some people
okay.
may relate to, having known if they have ever encountered the work of Rupert Sheldrake.
Mm-hmm.
You
yes,
probably know him because you know just about everybody.
Yeah, the morphogenic
right.
morphogenetic
yeah, fields.
Absolutely.
Right, which is not his idea, by the way. It comes from Arthur Koestler and some other people. But anyway, he wrote an interesting book. You know, he wrote about animals, how animals know
yes.
when their owners are coming home.
Yes, dogs who know when their animals come.
That's right.
Dogs who know when their owners come home, yeah.
When the other animals
it's,
get
it's
home.
Wonderful.
Right.
Yeah.
And he's then done some remarkable work on telepathy, and he also wrote a book or performed an experiment about people standing behind you, staring at the back of your neck.
Yeah.
You know about that?
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah. And so he showed, Rupert Sheldrake showed, that even the average person, you don't have to be psychic, can more or less detect when somebody's standing behind you, staring at the back of your neck. Now, why on earth would that be so? Well, let me just suggest this, and we'll go into it at more depth in the next interview. We all have this thing called the spinal column. Well, some of us have a spinal column anyway. Some of us are invertebrates, but We won't talk about those unfortunate people. Those of us who have spines have a spinal column. And in this spinal column, there is fluid, right?
Mm-hmm.
And that fluid is just like the fluid in a thermometer. So the fluid in the thermometer, which is mercury, last I heard, will expand and contract depending upon the ambient temperature. And therefore, you can read on the thermometer if it goes up, it's hotter. If it goes down, it's colder, right?
Yes.
Well, the spinal fluid is the opposite. It goes up when it's cold and down when it's hot.
Hmm.
When the spinal fluid goes up when it's cold is when you're afraid. It goes up. Spinal fluid goes up. This is an extremely subtle physiognomical process, an extremely subtle physiognomical response. And the place where the spinal fluid goes up and where it ends, where does it go up to? How far can it go up? It goes up into a part of your brain called the amygdala, which is in the back brain, or the R complex.
The R complex,
sometimes called the reptilian brain. And so that's why when you're really, really afraid, there is a sense of a chill going up your spine.
Hmm. Yes.
What's a chill going up your spine? It's the effect that you actually feel of the spinal fluid rising, because it rises with fear and drops with the lack of fear. And so this phenomenon, which everyone has experienced, everyone here I'm talking to can verify this. You've been terribly afraid, you get a chill up your spine, you become semi-paralyzed. But there's more. Oh man, is there more. And this is where the archons play into our fear. There's something that happens in the amygdala, which is the center of the R complex or reptilian brain, wherein the pressure of the rising spinal fluid activates the subtle circuitry, the subtle membranous tissue of the amygdala. And the result of that is that the amygdala excretes a substance called adrenochrome. Now, some people have said that this substance is invented and it's fictional and doesn't really exist. That's because it was first mentioned, I believe, in a fictional book called Neuromancer, a very famous dystopian novel. But adrenochrome really exists, and adrenochrome is the chemical equivalent of fear. And this adrenochrome, which is secreted in the amygdala when you're in a state of fear, feeds on itself. So if you're in a state of fear, you've got the spinal fluid rising through your spine, you're gripped with fear at the back of your neck, and the adrenochrome that's produced then creates more fear, which again creates the tendency for it to create more fear. It's what is called a positive feedback. I believe it's what is called a positive feedback, or no, it's a negative feedback response. Mm-hmm. In other words, it doesn't adjust itself. It just goes out of control. And this is a particular feature of human makeup for various reasons we won't go into. But the archons really take advantage of this. Now, the archons, how they do this, I would like to talk about at more length in the next talk. But I will say that that is the other way that they get us. You can imagine that they are, it is as if they are staring at the back of your neck. But I have to say that it's not as if you know what I mean.
Yes.
And so this is something we really need to understand, and this is something that we're also breaking out of. Because, you see, she's hitting the lower back with this strike on August. She's hitting actually the sacral plexus, and you better go and look up where that is. It's called the Svadhisthana in Hindu tantric yoga. located between the base chakra, which is at the root of the spine or coccyx, and the muladhara, which is the solar plexus. The Svadhisthana is the chakra associated in secret tantric practices with Bhairavi. You can read that in the book by David Frawley, which is about the 10 Mahavidyas. And the Svadhisthana is the sacral center. It's the true center of sexuality. And it's the center toward which the body melt converges. So, when you're in a state of great sexual pleasure, you're in the arms of your sexual partner, you're experiencing orgasm or just experiencing licking and kissing and caressing and sucking, and all the things that cause you to be deeply immersed in erotic bliss, you melt. Everyone knows that melting sensation.
Mm-hmm.
But you melt toward a certain point in your body. This is something that can be observed if you're particularly gifted to do so. And you melt toward the Svadhisthana point, which is the sacral chakra. And so that point is where in a certain kind of occult heat in the body can be stored and also released. So by hitting she's going to be hitting the Svadhisthana chakra. That is represented by the star Denebola and the tail of the lion. And that is to give us an enormous boost of inner bodily heat. Now, one result of that is that we could have spontaneous upsurge of kundalini, as I've mentioned, right?
Yes.
But her particular purpose in doing this, I can tell you the intent of the wisdom goddess is very, very precise. She's very precise in everything she does. Her intent is to activate the Svadhisthana so that each of us is capable of carrying more internal heat. Because that internal heat in the pelvis, in the lower part of the back, heats the spinal fluid. And the spinal fluid, when it's heated, rather than expanding and rising, drops. And so you remain relaxed, you remain in serenity, you remain in the warrior's mode. And the warrior's mode is serenity. Ready to kill at any moment, but totally serene.
Yeah.
You see? The warrior's mode is relaxation. And so she wants to bring us into a deep and powerful relaxation through this hit. And when you're in that relaxation, in the depth of your body, you can handle sacred anger. You can handle your sexuality as an instrument of power. You can handle kundalini as a weapon, as an instrument of warding off and even decimating archontic influences and decimating archons. You can decimate archons of kundalini with a glance. If you have enough kundalini in your body and you know how to direct it through your glance, can decimate archons. That would be, say, an ET presence coming to you in a threatening way. So she is, in a deep occult level, working upon us in the most fantastic manner. The wisdom goddess, divine Sophia. And all of this is for the same purpose, Thomas, to transform us into real human beings.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
We're freaks and we're deformities.
Yeah.
Because of our enslavement to the lies and deception of society, the programming of religion, parents, authorities, government, medicine, education, we become freaks and deformities. And we are so captured in the archontic spell of false power that we have lost the connection to our own real power. And the wisdom goddess brings us back to that connection. She is that connection, my friends. She is that connection.
And she's restoring that connection through these hits that come at the perigee surges.
Correct. Correct.
Very interesting. There's two things that popped into my mind while you're talking. And one is, you know, what is very close to my heart is Aikido. And the first thing you learn in Aikido is to keep your mind focused on what we call the point, the one point below your abdomen.
That's right.
It's about 10 centimeters below, yeah.
That's it.
That's the whole secret to all of it.
That's right. That's the Svadhisthana in the traditional Hindu yoga, of Kundalini yoga, piercing the seven chakras with the current of Kundalini. So this is a fantastic activation, not only of the human species, the whole human species in general, but a call to the warriors of Gaia, a call to the Gaian Echo sorcerers, and those who are now going to come to the front line in this fantastic planetary shift that we are undergoing, and going to stand up to the perpetrators, which is something I'll be talking about a lot in upcoming interviews.
Yeah, fantastic. I have some hints about what that is about, and it is definitely exciting, to say the least. Well, John, you know, I think it would be kind of silly for us to venture into anything else tonight, because that we couldn't do justice to really any topics that I have here. Let's just continue on with these when we can coordinate our schedules and continue on to number 12.
Certainly, Thomas. Just keep those notes and, you know, run through them. Select the high points that you want to cover, and we'll go right into it in the next talk.
Okay, fantastic. And we will start out with the Archon Plexus next time, and the significance of that, and go a little bit more in detail than we have so far. And is there anything that you would like to add as we sign off tonight?
No, just that, you know, don't forget that weather is a tremendous reflection of the presence of the goddess and the activity of the Dakini in the Shakti cluster. This morning around 8 o'clock, it's August 1st here in Spain. It's absolutely the hottest time of the year and the driest. This morning at 8 o'clock, I was writing the crew notes, and I got to the section where I was writing about Bhairavi, sacred anger, or as Miranda Shaw says, the goddess of transcendent anger. Beautiful passage on Bhairavi called Simamukha. It's another one of her names. It means lion head in Miranda Shaw's book, Buddhist Goddesses of India. And I was writing about sacred anger. I started to write about it. It's like 8 in the morning. And a tremendous storm came up outside, and it started to rain. Well, rain. Rain in Spain. Maybe in a song, but it doesn't happen in Spain in August.
Huh.
And we lost power in the whole house. We even lost power just now.
Just now, yeah.
When I was talking about how the break opening of the Cairo lock, will, people will exhibit the loss of the capacity to concentrate. Pow, the power went out. Anyway, look for turbulent weather. That's Dakini weather. And that's always a good sign for those of us who are warriors of Gaia.
Fascinating. Absolutely. I just want to add one more thing about Bhairavi. Is I was trying to read up a bit about her, and I was looking back at your writings that, where you've kind of written about impressions about things in the past. And Bhairavi, you seem to have a little bit of a trouble getting a grasp on what she's all about.
Well, it's extremely polite for you to put it in those terms.
You did seem uncharacteristically at a loss for words on her.
Yeah, well, I'll try to explain my feeble performance on Bhairavi the next time we talk about that.
Okay.
All right.
Cool. Fantastic. Okay, John, well, we'll set this up for the next talk here in a couple days.
Thanks as ever, Thomas. It's terrific talking to you. Bye for now.
Great. Okay, good night.